This line is burning, turning to ashes. It hits the ear. Every step is a day in the week. It's a Sunday or Monday, March all the months of the year.
Welcome to Nosecast. Homilies delivered in the Holy Gnosis of Thomas Chapel, the Ecclesia Gnostica, in Salt Lake City, Utah, by the Reverend Troy Pierce.
The intent today is divine aid towards liberation. And this is something that part of us tends to resist this notion. At some point, shortly after we learn how to say no to everything, as toddlers in our terrible twos, we learn how to say, I can do it myself. I can do it. We insist that we're able to do these things, of course, by ourselves. Even these things that are extraordinarily dangerous or complex or physically impossible for us to do. Little kids are really good at insisting that they can do them anyway. Well, this is a part of the learning process, to try to do something, and to see how far you can get with it, and see exactly how far you can get with it. Sometimes it's not very far at all. Sometimes the insistence upon doing something ourselves as kids is in order to get assistance in doing it. We insist in order to get assistance. So that when we start doing this thing, well, maybe this person can help me do it myself. And then if you have a certain personality, like none that I shall name among my nieces and nephews, then even with copious amounts of assistance, you still did it yourself. Well, this can be helpful in building up an ego, which one needs in the world. One needs a nice, stable, solid ego. It doesn't need as much as it thinks it needs as far as continuous praise and adoration, but it needs some foundation there. You need a well-developed aspect of oneself that can handle being in the world. That's the ego's job. But if we retain this childish notion rather than childlike notion that we can do things ourselves, then we've got way too much work on our hands as we approach any aspect of life. I can do mathematics by myself, so I can start with first principles and go work my way up to manifold problems. See what the zeta function's all about from arithmetic. Can somehow do all this stuff, sure, if you had infinite time and patience and resources and so forth. In the history of mathematics, there are people who have rediscovered all the principles of geometries were available to that age, merely by making a few or picking up Euclid's first laws or something. You can work this stuff out, no problem. But it's so much easier to see what somebody else has done and work it out from their example. It's no less your own. You still have to understand it fully to make it your own. There's a difference between merely hearing of these things, merely accepting the rules, say, of math, or the rules that the physical universe is governed by, and understanding them so that you could take this work of somebody else, and you're confident that you could reproduce it if you had to. This is sort of mastery over an understanding of the universe, certain domains. And so it doesn't lose anything except for that egoistic notion, I did it myself with no help whatsoever, which most likely is a complete lie anyway. You always have help. There's always more stuff going on. And so, if we look instead of at what might satisfy our personality, but the end result, it doesn't matter if you are able to understand the universe well enough to design something or solve a problem. Does it really matter how you got to that point? Does it matter whether you taught yourself in the basement with one book, or went to university that was well-renowned of having a strong discipline in that area, many famous faculty members, and you were able to learn from them? Does it matter to the problem? Does it matter to the solution? It doesn't. If you take a pragmatic view of these things, It is the accomplishment that matters. How we might perceive that within ourselves is a psychological matter. And well, we should always take a sense of accomplishment from accomplishments and understand where we are in the world and understand our level of understanding in the world, which is often further along than we think, but never as far along as we hope. But we should never found our identity upon these things, the needs of identity upon these things. To do that is to completely misunderstand the world and ourselves. We must do it ourselves in order to satisfy our needs, and we must delude ourselves in order to satisfy our needs. And we also must handicap ourselves in order to satisfy our needs. Work against ourselves. Not too good of an idea. We have limited resources as it is. Consciousness is limited. Energy is limited. Time, particularly in this particular age, extraordinarily limited. Don't want to tie one hand behind our back and juggle, because what's the point if the point is to juggle? I might take pride in that, but pride is one of the seven deadly for a reason. It's not really that useful. It might get you a job. It might sell products. But as far as developing as a human being, it's useless. An understanding of our own competence is what is useful. A trust in our own process is useful. Those are different than pride. Those are different than founding one's identity upon an element of pride. And so if we look at the spiritual development of ourselves, look at our own strivings towards liberation, sure, we can do it ourselves. It's possible. It's done before, as far as we can tell, to a fair degree by folks like Gautama Buddha, fellow Yeshua from Galilee. There are a few people who seem to have achieved this liberation mostly from their own work. But remember, these people also had teachers. Buddha had teachers in multiple traditions. Jesus was a part of a larger spiritual tradition. He had a mentor relationship with John the Baptizer. That's just what we know of. So something this important as one's own spiritual growth cannot be left to the do-it-myself part of ourselves. In fact, spiritual growth and liberation is not really the strong suit of our egos. They're not really cut out to do that. They are there and they have their form initially to give ourselves form in the world, to navigate through the world, to be in the pilot seat, as Jung said. But as far as growing to become more than an ego, there's a big shift that's required, a big quantum shift, or a huge growth spurt, or cracking the fragile shell around the ego that is required. And the ego itself is going to resist this. And even after this big shift, there will still be resistance from the ego. It's not to say that the ego is bad, but it has its place, has its limitations. It doesn't like having a place and having limitations. It wants to have what in military terms is called mission creep, which just sounds kind of like some sort of foot fungus or something in the army, but it's really the sense that given a mission to accomplish and giving some ambition to do more, you can slowly see the mission creeping larger and larger. You know, nobody's looking. We'll take over this thing. Nobody's looking. We'll take over that thing. The classic example is the Army Corps of Engineers, established way back. And its mission involved taking care of waterways. However, the phrasing was a bit vague. And so sometimes lakes fall into this, sometimes little streams, whatever. There's a whole lot of room to expand one's domain for the Army Corps of Engineers. Same is true for our ego. There's a whole lot of things it can try to expand and include in its domain. And if we do not bring consciousness to the whole of ourselves, then we may even think that the whole of ourselves is the ego and everything is its domain. Dr. Seuss is such a great mythologist, you know, myth maker. Yertl the Turtle is a lovely examination of the ego. King Turtle, king of all he surveys, has to be propped up by everybody else, but is still king of all surveys, falls down multiple times, still the king. And ego tries to get itself propped up and tries to take over more and more, tries to have its mission expand. However, that leaves us rather stagnant, because as I said before, it isn't that part of ourselves that is really dedicated to spiritual growth. After a certain point, the ego transforms and learns it can be a servant and a steward of something greater. But even then, there is some resistance at times. So, to look at divine aid, to seek it, to accept it, we need to kind of expand our notions of ourselves beyond merely I, merely ego. We are vast. We are much more. We are much more than we are consciously aware of. We are certainly much more than our ideas of ourselves, our identities. And so we must have the freedom to be the whole of ourselves in order to move towards liberation. We're not going to do it by cutting ourselves into little chunks and thinking we're only one of those chunks. And to incorporate divine aid is to be aware of the divine. The divine is a part of us, comes through us, comes up from the depths of ourselves. We can recognize it here and there. There's the phrase, the truth shall set you free. Longer phrases, and you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. And people today, at least our Orthodox brothers and sisters, think of this as being a promise that if you accept their doctrine, then you will be somehow free from the burden of sin that is also a part of their doctrine. So, accept their doctrine, you'll be free from their doctrine. And they don't see it as being a lived experience. But if we look at this again, the truth shall set you free. It is a way of understanding what the truth is. We can see it in the other direction as well. That what sets us free is the truth. It's not that we have to find the truth first and then be set free by it. But as we are liberated, as we include something into our understanding, into our gnosis, that frees us, then we know it has truth. We can look at divine aid towards liberation the same way. If it is liberating, if it seeks to free us, we can recognize the divine in that. We can see that that is divine, not just something bigger than ourselves. The gospel for today is one of those lovely weird ones from Philip, that God creates man, man creates gods. It is better that such gods were to worship men. Both in merely having ideas, we create gods. We create what we desire. We see some mirror in the heavens reflecting back ourselves, what we want to see there. Or more of a screen from a movie theater, projection screens so that we're shining up there, what we imagine to be there, what we expect to be there, what we must have there. So what one sees are multiple different god images. Maybe a completely vengeful, you're going to get yours, God image. Even though in the canonical scriptures, there are many parables about the fact that you're not going to get yours. This fellow Jesus, he had some wacky notions, and having God take revenge out on you was one of his wacky notions that he repeated. But still today, many people want to see that. They want there to be justice for others and escape for themselves. And so they paint this across the heavens. They make a god who is more in line with the Gnostic demiurge and is very much controlled by notions of getting his own, who has an escape clause in the form of Jesus so that you can have a universe in which everyone else will get punished for their sins, but you get out of hell free card. Well, it's one way of looking at these things that is very well established. That is an aspect of men creating God in their own image. We don't think of these things ontologically, that we are somehow creating the beingness of God, but we are co-creating the image of the divine. Everyone has spiritual experiences of some kind, to some extent, at some point in their lives. It would be hard to imagine somebody who is able to escape through life without having one. But the meaning that is put into can change. Be very different. So that can be put into a God image that is very vengeful. can be put into images of multiple gods. It can be understood all kinds of ways, the way we frame things in our minds, the way our culture understands things. So we have all of these perceptions and theories of God and of the divine. These are not really worthy of worship. They are our own and the other people's creations. They have created God, they have created gods, they have created divine ideas. And Gnostic tradition firmly asserts God is not apprehendable in that way. God is unknown, is beyond this full conceptual realization. So all these things that we are familiar with, that we are comfortable with, all these boxes we put aspects of the divine in, it'd be understood as merely boxes. The divine is beyond all of these things, beyond all of these forms. We can experience God many different ways. Gnostic tradition asserts this. There are many different mythological characters, if you will, in the texts. And those come from experience, come from having encountered the qualities of these beings. But all of these are emanations of a highest unknowable God. These are all ways to lead us back to that divinity. Another passage of the Gospel of Philip is the truth does not come into the world naked. We do not have pure experience. There is always something to the experience. We don't understand absolute divinity in this world, in these bodies, bound in a time as we are. So there must be something else at play. Ideas, notions, symbols, God images, traditions. We need to see those for what they are. Mere tools. Mere creations, co-creations. Just understandings that we or somebody else came up with as tools to understand God. Or as tools to try to not understand God. Jung very wisely pointed out that religion is most often a defense against a religious experience. We can have our ideas that block us from having an experience. Keep us from looking outside our little box of how we understand these things. The first part of the reading for today from Philip is also one of those lovely, weird passages. That in the garden there is two trees. One which produce men, the human being. The other which produce beasts, animals. That Adam ate from the tree that produced beasts and so begat beasts. Well, this could be seen as just thinking of Adam as being a bit simple, slow, not too bright. But if we kind of bring a more psychological understanding of these things, which is very firmly rooted in the Gnostic tradition, understand that what becomes a part of our process informs our process. We are not objects that are static in the universe. We do not have a simple being. We're not just of one nature in the world. We can't be just, say, a rock. Take the Charlie Brown example. I got a rock. So it can't just be a rock in the world that is either broken, weathered, or stays the same. I mean, those are the sort of the choices of being a rock in the world. We are so complex. We have both physical, psychological, and spiritual elements of this complexity, of this process of our lives. So we move through life. We change radically. We grow. Sometimes we're stagnant, sometimes we actually regress a bit, in all these different domains. And so what becomes a part of that process is very important. What we nourish that with, what becomes the foundation of who we are, is very important. Human being is not human by virtue of being, in the classical sense of this, in the world in which the Gospel of Philip was written. Humanness was something you had to attain through the humanities, through the development of the soul, humanitas. It wasn't a mere state of having human DNA, being human because your parents were human. You had to work at it. You had to manifest your humanness. I don't know if I want to use an example from Dune, but maybe I will. In Dune, if you've read the novel Dune, where you have an extreme test to see if you are human or not, you stick your hand in this box, you can't see what's in there, and it feels like your hand is being burnt off. There is a needle with a complete deadly immediate poison at your neck. So if you pull your hand out before you're told to, you will be immediately killed. And that this is a test to see if you are a human. A human can hold in their mind that this poison is very real and will result in death. That what is going on inside the box feels like your hand is being burned off, but even if it is being burned off, better than death, right? If you were an animal, the conception of the death, the conception of the needle and the poison, wouldn't really be enough to keep you from pulling your hand out. You would have this overwhelming reaction to pull your hand out. You wouldn't be able to override your instincts that tell you pain, bad, hot, remove hand, and you would die. Well, you see that this difference in this, of course, science fiction story can be taken all that seriously, but this shows an example that the difference is consciousness, is a particular development of consciousness and mind that understands, that is able to be in control of this physical nature, that it can override it at times, that if you need to go from A to B, and maybe you need to do that without eating, well, if you are conscious enough, you're aware enough, you have this self-discipline, you can do that. You can know that you're going to get to this distant area, that you'll be safe and alive, and you can go. Whereas if you merely are a slave to your physical requirements, you might go off some other way, looking for food. We see this repeated all the time in movies and stories and histories, that when people are fleeing from something or in this terrible situations, you know, often people give up. Like, I'm too tired to go on, even though another couple of miles, people are behind them, are going to kill them, and the person who gives up dies. So this notion of being able to override this overwhelming physical urge in this novel Dune isn't that far-fetched. This is a situation faced by humans, unfortunately, many, many times in our history. Many times today, no doubt. So we must see this humanness on top of the other things. It's not merely physical being. And if we do not nourish that part of ourselves, our consciousness, our souls, our spirit, mind, then we are eating from the tree that begat beasts. We are putting our physical, our instinctual lives first. And you can do that. You can bury your consciousness. This is one of those human survival mechanisms that isn't all that pleasant to see sometimes. You can bury your consciousness. You can do horrible things. You can commit genocide. And in doing so, you're being much more like a beast than a human. Whereas if you feed, nourish those other parts of yourself, eat from the tree that produces humans, then you will become human. You will not merely have the genetic structure, the physical makeup of human. You have the soul of human. And through that, you can manifest the divine spirit. Let's take a couple more minutes to talk about the lesson, which is really beautiful. You see that this is from an experience somebody had. Experience of returning to the earth from some apocalyptic understanding, some revelation experience. And that they're accompanied by an angel holding a staff, living water. That within the water and the staff there are leaves. Some are pulled out, and from those come prayers and sacraments. And the angel turns this visionary's attention upward to both behold and know the Father, gnosis of the Father, of the divine parent, the divine origin. And in turning that way, he addresses three requests. The first is to have mildness, in which there is no rebellion. And we can see this touching back the notion of the ego, the wanting to do it myself, the fighting against one's own liberation. To have no rebellion, to not have a war within oneself, to not work against oneself in trying to achieve liberation, to not be always in a state of civil war within yourself. Second request, to have a strong heart that can bear both great and small. We see in our lives that sometimes it's the little things that will be too much. That we're prepared to be heroic in some element or some aspect, but a lot of little annoying things, I just don't want to deal with that. It's not a part of my hero story. Other times, our commitment is such that we're able to handle a lot of little annoying things, but something big comes along, things break. The whole world shatters. The story of the world shatters. The way we understand ourselves and our world breaks. And the third thing that is addressed as a request is a smooth path which to ascend and return from the light. To have a way to experience the divine and return. That isn't merely out of the blue occasionally, once or twice in a lifetime, wow, is very important. Even if it is a difficult discipline, it's worth it. Take the time to have practice which you can ascend, see the light, and then return back to your life. It's essential to being able to continue on a growth towards liberation, through liberation. We must be able to reorient ourselves, turn the world upside down, so that our foundation isn't matter, isn't the world around us. That is the sure foundation upon which we build our life. But rather, the sure foundation becomes the divine, the transcendent, that part of ourselves that was before and will be after all of this. And have that be maintained in ourselves. We need to have a way to process that truth, to experience it, to see the light again and again. Daily practice in this world may be too hard to achieve, but at least a few times a week, be able to touch into an experience of the divine is very important, to be able to continue to live out this process. And this becomes, in so many ways, that fruit from the tree that produces humans, to be able to touch spirit, live out from the soul, in spiritual discipline and practice, but also in experiencing beauty, experience the things that feed the soul, whatever that works for you, be visual art, music, beauty in nature. All of these things aid us in reinforcing and growing those aspects of ourselves that are not the mere physical. We need to do those things. And in doing those things, we will give form to that divine aid. The old joke runs, person prays and prays and prays to win the lottery. And finally, after some decades of doing this, being very devout, maybe even having plans of what to do with the money that was be very charitable and useful, it's just really frustrated. Hey, God, you know, can't you do this little thing for me? You know, help me win the lottery. Of course, there's this voice that comes down. Well, you know, you could help out and buy a ticket. You have to do something for the divine to be able to have form. If you do not take the time to sit and clear some space in yourself, you won't experience it. It's there. If you have gnosis, you'll be able to recognize it. And as your gnosis grows, you can recognize different aspects of the divine throughout your life. But if you do not have consciousness, you do not have attention, if you do not take the time to do that, you won't see it. You can be the level of a beast, level of an animal in the world. Be a very clever one. But to really experience the divine, must open up to that experience. To experience the love of God, all you have to do is open your heart. Easier said than done. But it is there. So may we, you know, at least buy a ticket every now and then, a few times a week. Give an opportunity for this divine aid to become manifest, to become transformative in our lives. Recognize it and accept it, and then grow from it. So may the mystery that which hangs to extend descend upon us and learn this all.
More information and resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.org. And the Gnosis Institute at gnosisinstitute.org. If you'd like to continue receiving these podcasts, please consider a voluntary subscription of either $13 or $25 a year. That's $1 to $2 a month to make it possible to continue to provide this service.
Thank you.